Yes, okay. Somebody asked me a very good question last week, and I would like to elaborate a little more. The question was raised that if everything on the Sanhedrin, or on the Beis Din, those words are synonymous, by the way, Beis Din, Sanhedrin, we'll be using them synonymously. So everyone requires witnesses, so the question was raised, how could you have a system of justice? Because if somebody's, I think the question was that somebody's ox went on my field, then how could I, I'd have to have two witnesses to set them up in order to catch them, and et cetera, et cetera. So it would be very difficult. There are a couple of points I'd like to make with regard to that. It's a very good question. The first point is that you have to realize that the court could do, as I said last time, courts can make people swear, and we're talking here about a person, a society, where the Sanhedrin would enforce the law. So that would mean that all of the people in the society must keep the 613. So you couldn't have a situation where you have people that are open violators of the law. The individual laws must be viewed in terms of the framework of the society. So that is one factor. Of course, nevertheless, a person could say, but you still could have people that are that sneak by and are crooked and lying, which is true. And then you have the fact that the Sanhedrin used to use certain things, certain measures, psychological measures, and certain they make them swear, various things, which are, an average person really, even though you think it's easy to do, it's not that easy to do, as I mentioned last week. But there's another answer as well, and that is that there are really two agencies that enforce the law. And the one agency is the court, the Beis Din, the court. There is another agency also, and that agency is the king. And that's why there is such a thing as a king in Israel. The person, the function of a king is to enforce the law, and the way the king would enforce the law would, strangely enough, not be according to the prescription of the Torah for the Sanhedrin or for the court. In other words, he could do without any witnesses. He simply went by his own knowledge, his own understanding. And the purpose of having these two systems is precisely because of the question that was raised, that the system of the Sanhedrin is not enough, really, because there still can be people that are lawless, that sneak by the system. And there, if you're going to insist on witnesses and testimony, and if it's going to be so strict, as I was describing from the Mishnah the last time, then you're going to have a problem, because you're going to have people that are going to be able to evade the law. And that's why you have this other system, which is the system of the kingship. And the king operates functions according to his own mind, and not according. He is not restricted. He has absolutely no restrictions in terms of how he judges. And this can be seen from a few places in the Tanakh. And here's where studying the Tanakh, not just reading the Bible, but studying the Bible, offers us some insight. Take a look at, for instance, Samuel 1:8-20. Now this is a case where the people of Israel asked Samuel for a king. And they said in 8:20, will we also be like the other nations? But you see what their claim was. Their claim was, and our king shall judge us, and he shall go out before us and wage our wars. So the function of the king was really two things. It was politically, in terms of waging wars, and it was also to institute justice. The justice of the king is different than the justice which is instituted by the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is restricted by the type of evidence that's acceptable, and it's extremely difficult, as I said. For instance, to kill someone is extremely difficult because of all the specifics and all the requirements. But then there's another system, the system of the king. Now, the king functions according to his knowledge and according to his intelligence. He doesn't have the restrictions. And his purpose is, wherever the Sanhedrin, wherever he sees the system is failing, and he needs to move in order to bridge that gap, then that is his function. Now, if you take a look, for instance, in the in Kings 1, you find the same thing. You find that that when Solomon was appointed king, so then it states in Kings 1:3-5, it says, "In Gibeon, God appeared to Solomon in a dream of the night, and God said, what shall I give you?" And then some starts off with, as we said, he has the formula of praise first, and he starts off with the praise in verse 6, and then he says, and then he places his request in verse 9. He says, "You should give to your servant a heart that listens, understands how to judge your nation, to have understanding between good and evil, because who can judge this great nation, this honorable nation?" So you see that the request there was for judging. So you see again from that the function of the king is to judge, and that is because the Sanhedrin is not enough. Because the Sanhedrin has all these halachic restrictions and requirements. So at first, of course, the system tries to operate by the Sanhedrin, the ideal society, where you don't have to have the king intervene. But in the event that that's not enough, and many times that is not enough, then the king has to instill justice. Now it's very interesting, but if you take a look at that same paragraph where King Solomon asks for the knowledge to judge, and take a look at that famous story you have there. It says right after he woke up in verse 15, "And Solomon woke up, and behold, it was a dream. And he went to Jerusalem, and he stood before the Ark of God, and he brought sacrifices, and he made a great party for his servants." But then the very next verse is the beginning of that famous story. It says, "Then two women who were harlots, prostitutes, came to the king, and they stood before him. And one said, please, my master," and, you know, the famous story with the one child, and two people claimed their mothers, claiming this one child. Okay? Now, why do you think, what do you see from this? This is an amazing thing. If you look into, here's where you see how the Torah offers amazing insight, just casually, but you have to be observant. Now, what's interesting about this is the fact that the Torah immediately places this judgment as the first judgment that it mentions, you know, about the king. Now, what's strange about this judgment is, who are these two women? These two women just come off the street, which is amazing, and they're of the lowest class of people, and they come and they stand before this great king, King Solomon, the greatest of all kings. Why? How is such a thing possible? What do you see from this? You see from this an amazing thing, and that is that this, the king, no matter how great he is, there must always be access to him. From even the lowest ones of society, even the lowest level, the king is not permitted to make himself important by not allowing anyone to have free access to him. Anyone and everyone can go before the king. Of course, the king couldn't stand all day judging all the people. King Solomon must have had hours, you know, when he did this. But this was done on a constant basis, and it was probably done on the basis of first come, first served. You cannot have a king who is removed from his people or who refuses to see even the most simple individual. That's the principle of Torah. And that's why the Torah has this story right after it tells us that that King Solomon was given this knowledge, that he asked for this knowledge, and God promised to grant him this knowledge. So it shows you, it gives you the case, and the first case that it gives you is a case of that you would imagine would never even be able to take place. After all, if a man is a king, he's not going to know better to walk in, but no. The way of Torah is that everyone must have free access to the greatest person in the society, the king. There is no one too great that can remove himself from the people. That's an ethic of Torah. We see again this concept that the king is the judge. Not only is he the judge on big matters, which of course he spent most of his time doing, but he also must allow a certain part of it set aside where anyone can come before him, and he judges according to his wisdom. That's the famous story where it was splitting the baby. He judged according to his wisdom. He did not need any witnesses. He just used his knowledge and his intelligence. and that is part of the system of Torah. And you have the same thing in Isaiah, when Isaiah speaks about the King Messiah. He also mentions that he will, in Isaiah 11:4, and he will judge with righteousness, etc., etc., that verse goes on to explain how he's the greatest judge. So the greatest human judge is the King Messiah. So that's the same concept. So you have these two systems working hand in hand in Israel, in the system of Israel. One is the Sanhedrin, which works halachically. That's the halachic system. You must have witnesses. They must be. You must put them through the greatest scrutiny, separate them, cross-examine them, re-examine to see if everything fits. Anything is wrong, the testimony is completely discarded, and all these very specific laws and restrictions which the Sanhedrin must abide by. But then that is the preferable, that's the preferred kind of justice that the Torah looks for. But then you must have also a system of ordinary justice, because the society itself can't exist with the perfect halachic justice. The perfect halachic justice. Alone. So this is a very, very interesting concept. I find it interesting for another reason, because the fact that that you have the concept that that the person is equated to, like, the individual is equated to the state, in a sense, because you say a person is like a small world, and what this means is we find with regard to the individual. You have the same kind of a system. The individual has two systems. One system the individual has is the halach, and there he must use all the halachic means that the Torah gives man. And he must be very strict and abide by the letter of the law, just like the Sanhedrin had to abide by the letter of the law. Because every detail that the Torah gives is given by God, and it's perfected. Then on the other hand, the individual has to guide his life philosophically, his direction. There he must be like a king with regard to his own life. So you see, an individual here is equated to the state, where the individual has two systems and the state also has two systems. They both have a halachic, legalistic, specific, very specific, formal type of system which God gave him. And then they also have the system of freeing of the mind, where the mind has to use its own wisdom and its own knowledge and its own intelligence. There's no halacha that tells a person what should he do at this point. Should a person direct his energies towards doing this type of activity which will perfect mankind, or another kind, or should he perfect himself, or should he spend more time studying? What should his day spend in order to accomplish the most? What is the most expedient manner in which he could make use of his energies? In that type of a situation, the halacha doesn't help. You have to have the person has to use his own individual mind. So you see, man individual runs by two systems, and man collectively operates by two systems as well. Okay, so that covers that area. And now I'd like to go back to the Talmud that we were discussing, the tractate of Sanhedrin. All right? Now, we finished the Mishnah, if you remember. And now we are approaching the Talmud. Okay. Now, you have to listen to the... I'll give you the translation of the text of the Talmud, of course. And what you have to do is listen to it slowly, let it, and then we will see how we have to analyze it. And as I keep on emphasizing, the main thing is to learn the method of analysis. Okay, all right. Let's take the first piece of Talmud. Now we remember the Mishnah was discussing a person who blasphemes the Creator and the formula for it. Okay, and here's where the Talmud starts off, and the Talmud states at first. The Talmud states that we learned, which means this is a fact of the oral law, that a person when he blasphemes, if he curses the Creator, he has to use the Creator's name twice. He must use the Creator's name as the initiator of the curse, and then the creator has to be the object of the curse. Okay? Now, that is the fact that the Talmud states. It's a fact which is part of the oral law. No one can test it. Now, the Talmud says, now the Talmud raises the question, how do we know this? What is the source for this? Okay? So you'll tell me, well, the source is the oral law. That's correct. But you must remember that the oral law can come out of nowhere. The oral law always must have roots in the written law. That's a principle of earth. You cannot just have an oral law just floating around without any basis. Except in a case of a what we call a law to Moses from Sinai. And maybe one time I'll go into that, what that is. That's an exception, though. That's an exception to the rule. That's the only time we have a law of the Torah that has no basis, no roots in the Torah in itself. But otherwise, every other law always has to have some type of source, an allusion to the oral law in the written law itself. So the Talmud raises the question. Talmud says, now, where do we know this from? What is the source of this? That when the person blasphemes, he must use the Creator as the one who, you must say, Yossi, again, I'm going to use the word Yossi, that Yossi should destroy, Yossi should harm, Yossi should curse Yossi. And the word Yossi we're using in lieu of the Creator, because we're not allowed to enunciate such a thing. Okay, so the Talmud raises the question, where do we see this from? How do we know that this is so? Okay. Now, I'm going to raise a question on the Talmudic question. My question is this, that whenever a person curses, as I mentioned before, a curse is only a curse if a person uses the name of the Creator, okay? In other words, that's why I mentioned that I told my students, you should not say, God damn it, because if an individual got you, that's a curse, and it's a violation of Torah. So it's a bad habit to get into. But whenever a person curses, in order to violate the law of cursing, you must use God, the Creator, in your curse. If you don't use God, if a person just says, damn you, that's not considered a curse, according to Allah. That's just, he's angry. It's just the expression of anger. But a curse must have God's name. So my question is this. Now, why does the Talmud ask, how do we know that the Creator must be used here, the name of the Creator, we're going to use the word Yossi. Yossi should destroy Yossi. The Talmud asks, how do we know this? If I were there, I would say, since a curse always has to have God as the one who is doing the harmful deed, and over here, he is cursing the Creator himself, the only logical possibility is that the person should say, Yossi should Yossi. Okay? That's the only way that is logically capable, that logically one is capable of expressing the formulating a curse of the Creator, since by definition curse always means the Creator is the source. So my question on the Talmud itself is, what is the Talmud's problem? Why does the Talmud have to raise it? What kind of a question is this to begin with? The source, it would seem, is very simple, because since this is a curse and everything initiated by the Creator, so over here you're going to have to use the Creator twice, once as the source and second as the object. Okay, that's my question, all right? Now, let us just leave that question, keep that question in the back of our minds, and let's just forget about it, pocket it for a while. Let's just go back to the Talmud, okay? Now, the Talmud states like this. Talmud raised the question again, how do you know that you have to have this formula? Yossi should destroy Yossi. And the Talmud says, well, it can be derived from a verse in Leviticus 24. Because in Leviticus, where after that incident, where that individual did this, committed blasphemy, so the Bible says, so Moses didn't know what to do with him, so Moses placed his request before God, and God said, that this man is deserving of death. Okay? Now, the Torah, after that, the Torah universalizes. Moses received the law, and the Torah tells you the general principle. And that is in Leviticus 24, 15. It's a physician speaks saying, any person who curses his God shall carry his sin. And then it goes on in verse 16. And he who blasphemes the name of God shall be put to death. The entire congregation shall stone him. And then it states, the stranger and the sojourner, when they curse the name, they shall be put to death. Okay? Okay. Now, okay. So now, this is the verse which is the general principle. If you'd ask me which of the entire chapter, where is the verse that states halachically, gives you the formula, that verse. It is not the previous verses, it's verse 16. Okay? And the Talmud states that when you look at this verse, when you analyze this verse, the Talmud says you will see that he has to use the name of the Creator, both as the one who is the initiator of the curse, and also the one who is the recipient of the curse. Why? Because it says, the beginning of the verse says, he who curses, who blasphemes God shall be put to death, and then there was no reason to add the last part of the sentence. It should have just stated, he who blasphemes God shall be put to death, he stone him, this is so for the proselyte, and for the one who is the and for the one who is the citizen of the land. There's no reason to add the three words at the end in Hebrew that when they curse the name, they shall be put to death. Okay? There's no reason to add that at the end. It was unnecessary, extra. So therefore the Talmud says that that extra shows you that you must use God's name twice. He must use the God's name in terms of the being the source of the curse and also the recipient of the curse. Now, when you hear this, when you read this version of Talmud into English, the person like would say, "Well, this sounds kind of arbitrary." I mean, it could be that there are extra words here, but how does this show that that you must use the name of God as being the one that does the harmful deed, the one that does the harmful deed to Yossi. To you understand? How do you derive this from the fact that there are these three extra words? Sounds like the men of the Talmud were just being very arbitrary here. That's true. It does sound like that to a person who doesn't understand what the underlying principles are. But what I mean is that when you do understand what the underlying principles are, it makes perfect sense. Now, what I want to do though, before we answer this question too, so we have two questions now, is just to go a little bit further, and then we will and then we will come back and answer three questions, as a matter of fact. Okay, so you have to have a little bit of intellectual tolerance here. Let's just now the Talmud goes further, continues and says like this. It says, how do we know that this word, in other words, this is the verse. The verse, if you plus the oral law, zeroes in always on the halachic substance of the Torah. And the halachic statement over here is 24:16, as we mentioned. Now the Talmud says, let's take that statement of the Torah. He who blasphemes, who curses God, shall be put to death. But in Hebrew, the word is nokev, all right? So the Talmud says, how do we know that that word nokev means to curse? All right? So the Talmud says, because there is another verse in Numbers where Balaam says, how can I curse that which God didn't curse? So you see that, and it says the exact same word, nokev. Over there, it's echo, but the same exact root. So the Talmud says, you see, there's no other way to explain that other verse. From that verse, from the situation of Balaam, it's quite clear that his purpose was to curse the people of Israel, and that's why he said, how can I curse? And he used the word over there. So we see that word means to curse. All right? So that seems to settle the question, but the Talmud says there's another meaning for that same word. And that word, and the other meaning for that word, is to, strangely enough, because in Kings 2:12, you have that word no cave, and it's not just in Kings 2, it's used in Hebrew very commonly also. As a matter of fact, it's used more commonly, that word no cave means to make a hole in something, like to drill a hole. So the Talmud immediately raised the question. Talmud says, okay, so we know, that's how we know that the that it could mean to curse, but we still haven't proven it because there's another meaning to that word. That verb also means to drill a hole into something. So the Talmud says, and now how do we know that this verse which says, he who curses God, maybe it doesn't mean possibility. Now, how would it be, what would it mean, the other possibility? The other possibility would mean as follows, that if you took the name of God and you wrote it, let's say you wrote it on a, piece of wood, on a ballot, you wrote it on a little piece of wood, and then you drill a hole in it. You take a drill and you drill a hole in the name of God. Maybe that's what it means. And the Talmud says, as a matter of fact, that that's precisely what we do for the in the case of the by idolatry. When it says that one should wipe out idolatry in Deuteronomy, it says you should wipe out their name, and that means that you should destroy all the names of the idolaters that you find on their on their religious objects. And then it says, and you shall not do so unto God your God. And that's where the Talmud derives the fact that you're not permitted to any one of the names. If a person writes the name of God, you're not permitted to erase it. So the Talmud says, so maybe that's what it means. He who drills a hole in the name of God. You have a piece of wood with God's name on it, you drill a hole in it, and you destroy it. He who does that should be put to death. Maybe that's what it means, the Talmud says. So the Talmud says, no, that's not possible. Why? Because you need to use two names, if you remember. The formula is that you must say the Creator is the source of the curse. He should be the one that curses. And then you must say also that he's the recipient of the curse. So that would be impossible if you're just going to tell me that the violation is to drill a hole in this placard, in this piece of wood that has God's name on it. Because how are you going to destroy this name with another driller, with a knife or something? Okay? So the Talmud says, well, maybe it means that you take two names of God and you put one on top of the other and then you cut through with a knife. Okay? So it's like symbolically, like you're destroying, you have one name and you cut through that one name, then you cut through the second name to indicate, to symbolically portray the idea of one name destroying the other name. So the Talmud says, no, that's not really good because symbolic is not a halacha concept. Halacha always works in a physical way, in an actual physical way. And over here, all you're doing is just making a hole through one name, and then you're making a hole through the second name. But you